Being Married, Being Sexual. The sixth talk in a series titled Sodom and Sexual Purity was presented by Jack Crabtree on February 11, 2003, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. The following recording has a brief break in the middle and the loss of some teaching at the end. These are the result of the original tape switching to the second side and running out before the end of the teaching.
Many of you perhaps don't know Christine, so let me take a moment to introduce you to Christine. Larry, you have met. Larry has lectured a couple of times, two or three times in this series last fall, if you've been with us all along. Christine and Larry are married, and Christine and I, for several years, I don't even, well, 3 years, I think, maybe, did a radio program together, taped a radio program together called Christianity at Work. And I got to know Christine over that time and came to value her wisdom and her experience and her insight a great deal. I heard her speak a number of years ago on the subject of being married and being sexual, and so I very much wanted to make that a part of our series here tonight. But we're going to try to kind of use the format that we used during the radio program, when we were taping the radio program, and have kind of a conversation about the topic. We'll do that for the first hour or so, or 40 minutes or 50 minutes or so, and then we'll open it up for your questions, as we usually do. But I want to start by letting you get to know a little bit more about Christine and have her, in a way, introduce herself by giving us a little bit of her background. So, you're a counselor?
Yes.
How did you do that? How did you decide to do that?
Oh, gee. Well, to be really honest, I was going to college, and I met a boy right before I entered college, and I dated him almost 4 years. And at the end of the 4 years, we broke up, and I was going to be his wife. That was my goal. And he was going to be a pastor of a really big church, and as he is, I think it's like 6,000 people. And we broke up, and I was kind of like, with nothing to do. So I went and got a master's degree, because my father was willing to pay for it, and I didn't know what to do next. So I actually didn't start out as a counselor. I started out wanting to be the dean of women at a... I read a book about written by a dean of women, and I thought she was great, and I thought it was a really wonderful thing to work in a college, and it would be really fun. So I was going to be dean of women, and I ended up at an internship at Seattle Pacific University, and I took some counseling classes there, and I decided, oh, I would love to be a counselor. Excuse me. Take this off. As it turns out, it looked just like a fluke and just like irresponsibility, but I think... if God's sovereign, then He sovereignly led me through my own confusion to a place that really is right for me. And I consider it to be an honor to be in the lives of people as a counselor. I see myself as a miracle watcher. It's an amazing thing.
Okay. You and Larry have three children, two yeah. sons and a daughter, and they're growing up and almost... gone. How did you and Larry meet?
First time Larry saw me was when I was breaking up with that guy I was dating for 4 years. I can't believe it. I was going to the same school with him for 3 years and he never noticed me. This is like 5,000 people or something. Finally, I was breaking up with this guy and everybody was like going to the auditorium for something. And I didn't want to say that because I don't want to tell you the weird kind of school we're at, but it would bias them against me immediately. So, anyway, we saw each other there, and then we met just a couple of weeks after that. Larry was my best friend. What I'm going to say, a couple of years ago after I said it, someone came up to me and said, "I can't believe that you said that. It is so mean of you." But it's okay if Larry, and I'm going to say it, I just never thought about Larry as someone that I would marry. He just wasn't the kind of cool guy that I thought I was, I rated. And but he could be my friend, and he was kind, and he was thoughtful, and he was generous. And I remember walking into my dorm room, like, maybe a couple times after I met him, and I said, "Oh, I just don't know if I can even spend any more time with Larry, because I think I'm going to have to marry him." My roommate said, "No, you don't. You have to marry him." And I said, "I think I'm going to have to marry him." And I really fought it. I really fought it hard. In fact, I moved from Southern California to Seattle to get away from him. And you guys know Christy Brewster, and she was going to school at Seattle Pacific University. And she came up to me one day, and she said, "You know what, Christine, you just kind of talk about Larry all the time. And the deal is, I think you love him, and I think you just need to get straight with yourself." And basically, that was the conversation. And so that night, about 2 o'clock in the morning, I called Larry and said, "I love you. Let's get married." No, and so we did. We never really dated. I mean, it was like the perfect not having to try not to date, because I didn't want to date him. He was the guy I didn't want to marry. And so I really got pulled kicking and screaming into marriage. Good. Isn't that romantic?
Our topic tonight is going to be particularly making that transition from living a life of singleness and celibacy, if we obey the biblical truth, to becoming sexual beings within the context of marriage. And we're going to talk about that. But we've had a wide-ranging discussion over a lot of issues. As you look back on your life and your marriage and your relationship and so on, is there anything that strikes you as being, that you've learned in particular, that has surprised you or has been particularly borne out to be true by your experience that you would share with these people?
I mean, in a general sense or
sexually?
Yeah,
just about anything, about relationships and love and marriage and sex. And
Jack, I'd say everything.
Everything?
I was talking to Larry on the way here about how, you know, I said, "Well, Jack told me that he's going to ask me about our relationship and how it started, and what would I say?" And I think a conversation that Larry and I had, see, I don't know whether to talk to you or talk to the audience. Kind of both?
Yeah.
Okay. See, in the radio, we used to just talk to each other. And I would say in the first couple of months when we were married, I was thinking that Larry wasn't very appreciative of me because I'm not proud of this. It's awful, but I thought I was really great, and that he had really gotten lucky to have me as his wife. And people had told me that all my life, and lots of things that I did kind of turned to gold, and there was lots of advantages that I had, and I remember sitting on our bed, actually, and talking to Larry and saying, "You know, Larry, you're really lucky because I'm a really together person." And to have me as your wife, you're really lucky. And I unfortunately meant that. And he looked at me, and in the kindest of ways and the most piercing of ways said, "Christine, you're not together, and no one's together." And he was so right. And because I thought I was together, a lot of my life has been very much of a struggle and very much of a surprise to me. I thought that life was going to be really quite easy. I thought that my life would be pretty golden. I had no clue what was inside of me. No clue. And so I think that everything about life has been quite a surprise to me. about a week ago, somebody who knows me quite well and who I just spent some time giving to them, actually over several years in a very significant way, said to me, if you guys don't understand this line, maybe at the end you can ask me, but she said, you know, Christine, we're not very much, are we? You're not very much. And she was saying that out of a wealth of me having given to her the most that I have. And yet I think her reflection was honest, is even the most that we have isn't a whole lot. I wish that somebody had told me these things. I wish they had told me them a lot of times, a long time ago. In fact, when I was coming here, I thought, I wish that it was me 25 years ago sitting in this audience. I wish I wasn't almost 50 now and knowing these things. I wish I got married when I was almost 24. I wish I was at the oldest that old.
You ready to tackle that topic?
Yes.
Okay.
Actually, I think I kind of have started.
Okay.
Because I think that sexuality as life, paradoxically, has a lot to do with brokenness. I think when I was 24, I went into, or when I was 20 or 18, I went into understanding sex as something that I did, something that I would perform, something that would make me feel good. Although sex really does feel good, it has so much more to do with having in myself a brokenness of heart and a humility of heart that then I bring into my relationship with my husband. And that's out of that vulnerability that the meaning and the depth and the communication and the goodness of sex and the pleasure of sex and the desire of sex comes out. And I would never have thought that.
So you would have, from whatever messages, the culture, the whatever, you had seen it as simply an act to be performed. And so what the surprising part of that is how much it is a reflection of just who you are and where you're coming from, the risk, the vulnerability that you're taking and so on, and that that's part of the communication between husband and wife.
Isn't it all what the culture said? And even more so now. The culture says that it's this thing that we do, it's this act that we perform, it's this thing that we can kind of have prowess with. And if there's any prowess in sex, it has to do with my really, what I need to become good at is knowing my husband. What I need to become good at is knowing myself. What I need to become good at is being a giving person. What I need to be good at is being a receiver. And culture doesn't say any of that. It says, you know, how do you climax? And how do you do it fast? And how do you do it well? And how do you always do it?
Do you think, I don't know the answer to this, but you probably have more experience through counseling and stuff. Is that a tremendous pressure that's placed on people in our society that they can't live up to? I mean, is that just all one big lie? Those messages that we're getting through the media, the movies, the songs?
I think it's a terrible pressure. It's. Did I interrupt you?
No, go ahead.
I think for the context of what we're talking tonight, I'll kind of address that a bit. We were talking about the transition of being single to being married with the assumption of not having been sexual before marriage. And at least that's part of what we're talking about tonight. I don't know if there's many people who aren't sexual before marriage, and maybe we need to talk about that some, but be that as it may. Well, maybe I'll start with that. I was telling Jack, on one hand, I think I have like 10 minutes worth of things to say, and I think I have 3 weeks worth of things to say, so everything kind of segues into another thing. But going into marriage, having not been sexual, there's an expectation that I grew up with was, finally I get to have intercourse tonight, and I better be good at it. I better know something about it. And I didn't have, that came from such a misperception. And the misperception is that we have to be good at it, or we're going to perform it, rather than sex being a part of me that I become, and being sexual with another person is a part of us that we become, and we become that very gradually and over time. It isn't something that we have any more than when you start a marriage, that you have a depth of relationship at age 20 as you do at age 50, or even at age 50 as you do at age 70. But that the sexual relationship evolves over time, and that's a beautiful thing. There's hardly anything else in our world where we think I have to do it and I have to be good at it now. I was trying to think of an example of that, and when I was in college, I went to Europe for 3 months, and one of the things that I did to prepare for it is I took German for a couple of years in college, so that when we went there I would be able to speak the language. So in that sense I was kind of preparing myself to be there. I was also preparing myself in a sense of all of life. All of life kind of trained me, or doesn't train me, to go to a foreign country and be able to deal with what it asks of me. And I think that's so similar to being sexual. We expect ourselves to all of a sudden be able to be good at it, whatever exactly that means, but rather than like going into a foreign country with some preparation and coming into it with an expectation of learning, of exploring, of growing, of not having known and going, oh, that's it. Of continuing to know more and more, to see more and more, to know more about me and the culture, to know more about the other people. That's how we do life. But it seems like with sex, we're supposed to be different. We're supposed to know it. It's like a long jump. You do a 10-foot long jump. I don't know if that's long for a long jump, but you know, you jump really far. What is that, a 30-foot long jump?
10 feet is long for me.
Yeah, it's really long for me, probably. Anyway, shows I don't do long jumps. I don't know where I came up with long jump. But, you know, it's like this thing, we're supposed to like get there. And if we go into marriage or into sexuality thing and we're just supposed to be there, it just takes all of that beauty away of the exploration and the discovery, and it makes it pressure of something that I have to do. And when we're under pressure, we don't do so well. So did I answer your question?
Yeah, so that's a good point, that we...
Thank you.
That learning together is actually part of the joy and part of the beauty of it. And
I think
it is.
I think the process of it is it.
Is it? Okay.
It's it. I mean, it's wonderful to get to know my husband. I mean, it's like this lifelong getting to know, not just emotionally, not just socially, not just psychologically or mentally or cognitively, but mixing all those together in their expression physically. It's an incredible thing, the process of that.
So once again, the preparation is all about an attitude, a spirit, a relationship that I'm going to enter into, being able to enter into a relationship. That's really what it's in the end going to be all about. The actual mechanics and act of sex itself is going to be something that we learn together. The relationship is the thing that I need to be prepared to enter into, and I need to do the relationship right in order to be able to have enough of a relationship to make that a
well, but the problem is I don't do relationships right. I mean, well, I do relationships really wrong. I'm really a failure in relationships. And I think it's that recognition that I'm a failure in the relationship and I'm going to blunder and fall and trip and knock you over. You know, you and I have knocked each other over a number of times. Actually, Jack and I are in the process of an unresolved issue between the two of us, and we're blundering in it. Would you say so?
Yeah.
He's laughing, but it's true. You know? Jack and I are having a problem with each other. Would you like us to work this out? Actually, I shouldn't speak for Jack. I've been having a problem with Jack, and we haven't addressed it yet. So I don't do relationships well, but it's kind of that recognition. That's part of the brokenness, is knowing I don't do it well. I really make a mess of things. And it's that recognition that I bring into... that it's that vulnerability of that that I... that makes my relationship work, because it's not always just this self-righteous, I do it right and you do it wrong. But I think when I do relationship most right is when I know I do it really wrong a lot. So, but it is, you're right, I think that it is the emphasis on relationship as opposed to an act. That's the beauty of it. That's where we need to go with it, because it is the act comes out of the relationship with some education, certainly. Some practical education is certainly helpful, and we can go to some of that. But it so much arises out of the commitment, the communication, the willingness to trust, the vulnerability, the risk. That's where the sexual connection comes. That's certainly where the desire comes for women, is out of that connection.
Okay. You said, you know, maybe we're not at a place in our culture any longer where there are people who are not sexual before marriage. What exactly did you mean, and what's the upshot of that for our culture today?
Well, I remember 25 years ago when I said that I was a virgin before I got married, people were shocked. That was 25 years ago in September. Though I probably need to define that. I think I did kind of a... I don't know, this might not be politically correct, but I think I did kind of... I was kind of a Clintonite virgin, if you know what I mean by that at all. He said I didn't have sex with that woman. Well, as far as we know, he didn't have intercourse with that woman. And that's what I thought not having sex was about. But I think having sex is about a whole even attitude of being toward another person. It can be extremely sexual. It can be extremely seductive. It can be extremely arousing. It can put me in a context with another person by the way I act, by the way I use my body. That can be very, very sexual. And that, all the way up before intercourse, is a lot of what I did and called myself a virgin. And so I would say now I really wasn't. But... so I don't think many of us, including myself, go in somewhere in that spectrum. We go in into marriage, and I think there's a way in which that's just one of our mistakes. It's not that I want to say let's take it lightly, but I think we have these sexual feelings that come up in all sorts of contexts and that are brought out in all sorts of ways, and we act on them in some way, lots of us, and we fail. And I think what we need to do with those is say, oh, I failed. How do I want to grow and learn and back up from that? As opposed to, oh, I failed. Oh, well. Or justify it in some way.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess I'm thinking of the context of our culture now. I work with a lot of college students from the university, and actually many of them are people that would consider themselves to be Christians, some of them not. But I have been increasingly surprised over the years of counseling, and I've been a counselor for probably about 26 years, 27. The increase in sexual promiscuity, what seems to be more common today is just a given, just an absolute given that you were going to be sexual. I was talking to a young man who grew up in a Christian family who was actually quite angry with his folks that they had had the audacity to teach him that there should be sexual purity before marriage, or even that that would be a good goal to go toward. He was very angry and talked to them about how he'd missed out on recognizing himself and knowing himself, and what a disservice they'd done to him. And it was to him like, way duh. Even though he'd grown up in this Christian family who really valued that, like, what in the world were my parents thinking? That is so stupid. And what I'm hearing a lot is there's a whole lot of bisexuality, women with women and women with men, and, you know, men with men, you know, all sorts of mixes. I hear a lot about threesomes getting together or couples getting together. I hear a lot about people having very casual sex. A woman was telling me, for example, if you have sex that night and then that morning when you wake up and, oh, she was actually relating a story. They had sex one night and then the next night they happened to be at a party together and she went up to talk to him and he said, "What right do you think you have to talk to me? I mean, what's going on?" You know, that you know, essentially that meant nothing at all. So lay off. You don't own any claim to me at all. And she was kind of familiar, kind of like, "Hi," you know. And that is the kind of thing that I hear more and more frequently. It's so I don't know who I'm talking to tonight exactly. I don't know if you guys come from that culture, or that's what you've seen, but that's very definitely what I see as a counselor working with a lot of students from the U of O and the high schools.
And do you see any sort of negative or positive correlation between their degree of sexual experience and how that would translate into being married and being sexual within marriage?
I think they have no experience with sexuality. Okay. They have experience with doing an act, with having a performance, with feeling pleasure, with learning to be seductive or sensual. They have experience with pleasure in themselves. They have experience with giving in to their passions. But sexuality, at its best, is so much richer than that. It's not that. It's the other day, my daughter, who's 14, said to a friend, "I'm going to be a counselor." And he said, "Oh, well." She was talking to a friend of ours who's probably 55, and he's been a counselor all his life, very old and sage-like, and he goes, "Oh, well, that's a difficult profession." And I said, "Oh, no, what she means is she wants to be a camp counselor." He goes, "Oh, okay." I get it. And so I call myself a counselor, but I've been a counselor for a long time. That's very different than when I was a camp counselor as a teenager. And I think that's really a good distinction with sexuality, is I think we can be camp sex people, or we can be therapists for a really long time and they're still called counselors. And I think that distinction is something that if we don't get, we miss out on the depth and the beauty of sex. It is probably the most beautiful thing that God made. I think so. And I love gardening. I love beauty. I love nature. I love flowers. I think that I love the smell of the ocean. I love, we took a hike up Sahali Falls, and I love the crisp air and the ferns and the sun coming and the falls and their power and their thunder. I love that. sex is better than that. It's bigger than that. It's more, Jack doesn't like this word to use with sex, but in that context, I think it's more sacred than that. It is amazing that God made sex. It's amazing to me. It's amazing. Did I answer your question? I lost it again. I got lost.
It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. Is there more to say by way of defining sex in the way that you're talking about it than distinguishing it from the act that you haven't already... You've talked about vulnerability and relationships, but is there anything more that you can say to define what you mean by that?
Well, my husband said to let go of my notes, and I've tried really hard, but I have this list of what sex is, so I'm going to kind of go through it. At the top of my list is learning to trust. Actually, a person that's not so trustworthy because they're a sinner, and being vulnerable with them anyway. Learning to risk that vulnerability. I think at its bottom, it's learning to trust God. Isn't that an amazing thing? I never would have thought that for sure 20 years ago, but I think sex is a big way that I learned to trust God, because it's, for me and for a lot of people, sex is a really scary thing. One of the things that I do a lot in my work is I work with people who have experienced some kind of significant trauma. And very often, as it turns out, I've worked with people who have been, and I work now with people who have been sexually abused, and or often heinously so. Things that I often describe it as Holocaust-like, things that people experience often from their fathers or their mothers or their uncle, someone they know, someone that they have trusted. And so for them, to work through their sexual abuse, sometimes I think that they are at an advantage because they have to take seriously their sexual relationship with another person, and they have to work at it so hard and so intentionally that they come to understand what sex is in a way that sometimes us who take it casually, who think we know, and we don't really know, they gain from that. When I grew up, I had one experience of sexual abuse. It was my piano teacher would sit by me and put his hands down my pants when I played in the piano. That was scary for me, and that's been something, though, that hasn't impacted me as much as it could have, and much as it does for a lot of people who don't have perhaps some of the resources that I've had, at least later in my life. I'm not going to go in and explain all that. But I think one of the things that was most difficult for me, or two things, and this pretty much impacts most everybody, is the culture and its message of sexuality, the pressure, the performance orientation, the act, the let's just go for pleasure thing. And another thing that really impacted me is I was taught to be a man. My father was very critical of my mother, and I came to be very critical of women. That's a problem because I am a woman. And so what I did is instead of being a woman, and of course I couldn't be a man, I became kind of a in-between. I came kind of a neuter. And so my I didn't come into being a sexual person very easily, because if you're not a man and you're not a woman, it's kind of tough to be sexual, to experience it very fully at all. And so when I talk about trust and vulnerability, I really understand from my own work at needing to be vulnerable, really sex required that I become a woman. And women were less than, in my mind. That was my belief system underneath. And so I had to kind of be had to learn what that was about, and it was kind of demeaning. It was kind of a put-down to be my own sex. So I guess I don't know exactly where I started with that, but I think it has a lot to do with learning about myself, with learning to be vulnerable, with whatever messages I have, with whatever experience I have, with whatever history I have. I don't want to repeat myself, but I'm going down my list. On a very different side, I think that sex has a lot of faces. Sex can be, I don't know, sex always is the most beautiful thing in the world. But it also can be, as I'm talking about sex as something beautiful and something sacred and something awesome and not just pleasurable, I certainly don't want to leave out that it is incredibly pleasurable. It's like amazing that God gave us this pleasure thing. That's so great. It's better than, I really like food. And those cookies out there, you know, I'd usually eat those, but I went there and I was going to pick up a couple. It is an attestation of how nervous I am that I didn't pick up a cookie. Because Larry will tell you, I always eat cookies and there's chocolate back there. I didn't take one. Didn't even want it. But it's better than chocolate cookies. It's funner than fun things. Sex can be very playful. It can be, I don't know, be more fun than your Larry's favorite basketball game. It can be better than, you know, anything that we do together. It can just be really just playful and lighthearted and good. Do you experience that?
Yeah, that I like the way you put it. It has many different faces. Everywhere from whimsical at times to very, very serious and very
sober,
very laden with meaning and bears a lot of meaning. And other times it's just more playful.
Yeah. Yes. On the ends of the spectrum, sometimes it's, you might not like this word, sometimes it feels very spiritual. It's like this connection between the two of us that is so deep, I cry because it means so much. There's so much giving and receiving there. It also can be, and so sometimes it's, what else did I put? Oh, sometimes it's very energized and very, very passionate and very alive and very, and usually when it's that way, it's experimental and risky and I don't know, it maybe feels like men used to feel when they were warriors. You know, it's like has all that sense of, you know, I'm learning something, I'm doing something, this is so cool. It's like I'm, like one time I climbed the Grand Canyon and I learned how to do that. It was like, wow, but with passion mixed with it. Does that make any sense?
Mm-hmm.
Kind of those two together. Sometimes it's really short. Sometimes it's just a gift because I want to give it even though I'm really tired, because it's just a way to say I love you really quick. And sometimes it's very long and yeah. Can you think of any other ways it is? Any other face it has?
No, I can't. I mean, I think you've covered it.
Maybe I don't want to think of it.
Could you explore a little bit, though, the risk, the vulnerability? I think you've given a good sense, a good feel for that. Have you been able to analyze that at all? What are we risking? Why are we vulnerable? Why should it be that way? What is it about sex that brings that vulnerability out there? Because the relationship does too.
If the relationship isn't vulnerable, then my sexuality would be vulnerable.
Hmm.
I don't think. I don't see how it can be, because I think they feed in and they match one another. There's an expression in my sex that has to, I think, it has a prerequisite in my emotional connectedness. And they work hand in hand with one another. The vulnerability of an emotional relationship is so very difficult, because what I'm used to doing is having some kind of strategy to protect me from what I'm afraid of, and I'm afraid of a lot, we all are, or to try and drive me toward connection in a way that I'm actually taking myself away from it. Does that make any sense? For example, I might give up myself, I might become very compliant in order to love you. And what I think I'm doing is giving of myself, but what I'm doing is out of fear doing what you might want me to do so that you'll love me back. So I haven't really had any vulnerability at all. I haven't really loved you at all. I've just had this strategy that protects myself that kind of manipulates you into giving me what I want. Another way that we relate that's not vulnerable at all is lots of times we withdraw. How are we doing for time? Oh, we're almost done. I see that a lot with women, for example, in sex. What they do is they bring their bodies because they have this duty or this thing they're supposed to do. We need to talk to Duke about duty. Remember that one. And so what they do is the lights are on, but nobody's home. They're dissociated from their body. They're split from their body. They're separated from their body. And it's kind of like, wake me up when you're done. Because what they have done has not been vulnerable in their relationship, perhaps over years, or in themselves, so that they don't have themselves to offer sexually because they haven't done the work of knowing themselves, of knowing the other person, of facing into what they're afraid of, which is the work of life, is to face in, to know ourselves, to have God's light shine on us and say, okay, this is who you really are, and to work with that. Instead of doing that, we're kind of always working at protecting ourselves because something might hurt us or we might get rejected. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. And then just very particularly for sex, I don't know if you're going to want to give this tape away, but sometimes I think that I would like to have a penis because I'd like to know what it's like to be enveloped as opposed to the enveloper. I was reading a book, and in the book it said, actually a long time ago, but what men do is penetrate women. Given that to Larry, kind of forced or coerced him or hurt him, and I've done that to you too. It's a bad word, but there's this enveloping that women do. And in order to envelop, you have to allow a penis to come inside you. That's a very physically vulnerable thing that I think is a picture of our emotional vulnerability with each other. And lots of times women can't do that without a great deal of pain. I work with a lot of women who's are unable to relax enough to open up and welcome the man inside of her. So just from a physical standpoint, I just think it's such a match to what we're doing emotionally. However, I do think that people can train themselves to be sexual people who do sexual things and can be very sexually turned on and be very sexually experimental and exploratory, but they're camp counselor sexual. They're not the kind of sexual that I'm talking about, which comes from an openness of my heart, of my life, of myself. That is so much richer and so much fuller and so much bigger than what we hear on the movies or what we see on the movies. That's a tragedy because we lose the beauty of it, the bigness of it. Are you with me at all? Do you agree?
As I get older, one of the things that I recognize is so tragic about that is that you're not, for the rest of your life, going to have the energy for that. And so you have nothing left at the end, I would imagine. Yeah. If that's all you had, you have nothing left at the end, whereas the relationship can just grow richer and stronger and more, I mean, you're more skilled at the relationship, even if you're no longer even interested in performing sexually. So
I don't know, but sometimes I have more energy now than I did as a kid because there's like so much more to go for. It's it's so much better. And I wouldn't say that's sustained. It's not like...
Well, you're not old enough yet. It's coming.
How old are you?
I'm not going to go there.
About 3 years older than me, so I have about 3 years left. You know, that is, it is very true, though. I mean, I think probably one of the biggest issues in my life is I'm always tired. And being sexual and being tired don't go together really well. And I have to really work at not being tired in my life. It's my job. As a kid, at 20, I didn't have to work at not being tired. I could do as much as I'm doing now and never be tired or more. So.
Yeah.
Okay.
Duty.
So, duty. Yeah, I didn't finish saying what sex is, but we'll talk about duty for a minute because there was a talk you gave once, Jack, and you said that it's our duty to be sexual, and I probably have a history of redefining what you're saying, and I'm going to do that again. I don't think you probably meant that we have a duty to have intercourse, but I think that's how a lot of people would read it. I think our responsibility. And I would like to change the duty word to the responsibility word. Our responsibility as married people is to become one. And what does that look like? Well, for someone who's been sexually abused, they may have to not actually have intercourse for years out of their marriage in relearning how to be safe, relearning how to be sexual because they have such a horrible experience. Well, if we say they have a duty to have intercourse, then they've failed. But if they take on the responsibility to work toward being a person that's vulnerable and open, and that working itself out eventually in a sexual relationship with another person that's full, then I say that they have very much carried out their responsibility. And perhaps what a parallel I'm thinking of, I work with people who sometimes it is so incredible that they showed up to my office and they didn't kill themselves today. It moves me that they were here. I walk in the door and they're there. Wow. And other people might criticize them because they weren't able to take a shower or they can hardly make any money or they look like real failures in the world. But I know they're not. In fact, I know that they did a whole heck of a lot more to get to my office in one piece than I did. To do this job and to be what the world would call successful in a lot of ways, I don't have to put nearly out as much energy. And so I think we need to really work at not comparing ourselves to other people, but comparing ourselves to what our history is, what our fears are, what our expectations are, what our teaching is, and start there with ourselves. And our responsibility with our marriages, rather than something up here that has nothing to do with the reality of our own unique personal lives that God gave us. Would you agree with me?
Yeah, I do.
Okay.
I do.
So never use the word again.
Yeah, almost that. Did you have more you wanted to say about defining sex?
Let me just give you some, are they called synonyms? What's like? It's discovery. This is kind of the lighter side. It's pleasurable. It feels good. It's warm. It's soothing. It's nurturing. It's exciting. I think what we yearn for more than anything else is connectedness in our lives with other people. And instead we have so much isolation. And this is such a picture of connectedness that God gave us. I think he was saying, what a gift that I'm giving. You know, he gave Adam and Eve to each other in the garden. And then he also, they didn't have sex in the garden. I don't think it ever talked about that. But we get to have sex too. And wow, what a picture of connection. And God's saying, I want you to connect. Here it is. And that's what our hearts desire more than anything. And I think our unhealth, our pathology, our neurosis comes out of an isolation that we have from ourselves and from other people. So it's an expression and a deepening of emotional closeness and mutuality. It's lifelong, it's gradual. It's like walking into when I was growing up, I had some relatives that lived in this castle. It was like the most incredible place for like a 5-year-old to be in, because there were these huge rooms downstairs and these staircases that went up with, you know, massive, maybe 10 feet across and gorgeous, and rooms with bay windows, huge rooms like this, like bedrooms. And then there were these secret passages, and you had to, like, there were these little doors that we found. And this is like Alice in Wonderland. I mean, like, wonderful. You can't believe that it was real. And we'd open these. I remember the first time opening these doors and going up this little tiny hidden staircase. It was like hardly big enough for a little kid to climb up. And we came into a ballroom. A ballroom. I never figured out how to get into the ballroom from a main staircase. I only always knew it from this little place. But that's kind of how sex is. It's like you get to know more and more and more. And it isn't that it gets smaller. It gets bigger. It's like a room, it's like a castle that has more and more and more rooms that I don't think ever end. I haven't seen it end. I don't think it'll end.
You're not old enough yet.
I know. Jack is an old stick in the mud. Okay. It's about communication. It's about a deep expression of me and a deep expression of you. I probably haven't said it all, but that's mainly what I think of it.
We are sort of running out of time. If we're going to leave time for questions, so just one more question. So does something of primary importance come to mind if you were to say to the young women in the audience, the best way to prepare yourself for a lifetime of sex and marriage, what would that be?
It's a lifetime of learning how to be broken, how to be not protected, how to be understanding what God says about life. And I would want to sit down and unpack that big time. But I think if we forget, that's the title of the book, and I think we forget the title of the book and we go into details, and then we miss the bigness of it, the goodness of it. And so I would say to any of you, men and women, that you connect yourself with people who understand sex in a way that's big and that's beautiful. If you go to somebody and they say, well, sex, when I first got married, I told this story once a long time ago, I was kind of clueless, and Larry said, let me get a friend to kind of come talk to you. And he had this guy friend that was married, and his wife came and talked to me about sex, and she said, well, you know, her basic, as it, you know, boiled down to it, she said, Christine, there's just some things we have to do for our husbands. She ended up about 2 years later leaving her husband for a woman. She didn't have a clue, and I would really obviously recommend that you not talk to somebody like that, that you be careful who you talk to. And that was kind of like, thank you, bye. I even then knew this is not helpful. But somebody, if you ask them about sex and they say, sex is beautiful, sex is hard, sex has been a learning experience, sex is awesome. If they can kind of tell you both sides, then there's someone to sit down and talk with, because you can glean probably a lot from them. And I would say to all of you, I learned in isolation. It took me so many more years than it needed to. And I was fortunate, because I have a husband that I stumbled into. I don't know. How did I ever get Larry? I don't know, because he's so accepting. He so much wants me to be me. Even now, I get scared when we're having sex. And you know, you can throw away this tape, but sometimes he's just highly aroused and I turn off. And he stops and he backs up and he never shames me and he never pushes me. And he just backs up. And I think that there's very few times that I don't end up coming and joining him again. Out of his lack of force, out of his lack of pressure. That's the way he lives life with me. That's a gift. Find a husband like that. That's what I'd say to women. Find a husband like Larry. But even in the context of Larry being my husband, it took me a long time to understand. And so I would say, connect with couples. Connect with men and with women who understand this. Help them, ask them to share themselves with you, ask them to give you information. There's very, very, I would like to say read. I can't hardly tell you anything to read. I tell you not to watch movies because I think that the movies have, across the board, I hardly like to watch movies or TV because it's so cheap in sex. And I like sex, and I like it to be beautiful and big. And it always, it's like I'm not as offended by it as I am saddened by it. I hear so much about sex. I mean, I think I've probably been doused in sexuality and sex stuff so much through my counseling that probably I've had more of the rotten, ugly, stinky stuff than most anybody will have in a lifetime. But that's in the context of people wanting to be real and people wanting to open up the eyes of their hearts. That's people wanting to know the truth. And I'm really saddened that it's taken away from us in the media. So I would talk to people. There's a book that I brought tonight. It's called The Sexual Healing Journey. And there's nothing Christian about it, but there's some really, if you've been sexually abused, this is a particularly good book to read, although she leaves out most of what I've said. It actually is a pretty good manual. But there's some questions in it that she asks. And one of the things that I would suggest that you do with yourself or with your mate is that you talk about your fears, your expectations, particularly your beliefs, and about what sexuality is, and about she has this list that you can go through that just kind of, I think, not the list itself is so great, but it can bring conversation. I went through this list with a woman just a week ago, and she said yes to all of these things, and I'll read this list really quickly as by way of example. We're going over, but I'm going to do that. She'd been married probably 15 years and had been giving in to having sex but not being there. She kind of like turned out her lights and he did whatever he did, and then she ended up being really afraid of him and couldn't be sexual after a while. And he said to her, well, I'll go through this list. She said yes to all of these things. I feel sex is a duty I must perform. I feel sex is something I do to get something else. In sex, one person wins and one person loses. Sex feels dirty to me. Sex feels bad to me. Sex feels secretive to me. I equate sex with sexual abuse. Sexual energy seems uncontrollable. Sex is hurtful to me. I believe sex is something you either give or you get. I feel sex is power to control another person. Well, you can imagine that if she had talked about those issues 15 years ago when she first got married, and work through these with her husband, they would have been way ahead in terms of their understanding of each other. Now, 15 years later, they're having to... She basically has felt sexually abused by him. Not that she sees him actually as an abuser, but because of her giving up on expressing what it meant to her and working with that, they have to, like, go back a long time. So I would encourage you, this is a book with pages of questions to kind of help spur conversation. And I'd say another thing, just in a practical way that you could do is to know your body. And I think as Christians, it's kind of, I don't know, to me, I thought it was kind of taboo, especially since I wasn't seeing myself as a woman. I didn't need to know or explore my body. But that's really a loss. And I would really encourage people at whatever age to get to know your body. One of the things that can be really frustrating in a relationship is your mate tries to sexually please you, to arouse you, and if you don't have an idea of even how your body responds, or what you can't help them learn that either. So it's, you need to know yourself enough to teach them that. You also need to be comfortable enough with your body that you share it. I think it's very sad that I work with lots of women who feel like they can't even undress in front of their husband. They're ashamed of their bodies. And so getting to know our bodies, I probably haven't said it all, on lots of different levels, I think is really, really valuable. I could go on and on, so we'll just stop.
Okay. Well, let's open it up to you for your questions and your interaction.
And Jack gets the answer to these too, even though I did most of the talking.
When I was, I think in my late teens, I had a conversation with a female relative who probably shouldn't have been telling me this, and it made me very uncomfortable when she did, but she was complaining about her husband, and she said, "Did you know that my husband has not made love to me in 12 years? And I thought, "Oh, I definitely don't want to hear this." But at the time I thought, her husband, I liked her husband. Her husband was a very kind man, and she was, quite frankly, a shrew. And I'm sure that he could have been a better husband, but what I would guess, if I had to guess what happened in their relationship, is I'm guessing he couldn't have been a good enough husband to help her transcend her shrewishness. Now, that's just my guess from observing the relationship. But at the time she said that, I said, I can't imagine, I thought to myself, I can't imagine why your husband would want to make love to you, because if I were your husband, I wouldn't want to get within 10 feet of you. And it had nothing to do with her appearance. She was just, she was an ugly person inside, a hurtful person, very narcissistic, expecting the world to revolve around her. And the times that I had approached her to try to tell her how she affected me was just, I'm not saying I was any great skilled at doing that kind of thing, but I don't think I was so unskilled that that I was doing it so badly. So my question is this: if a woman finds herself in married to a man who, despite all her best efforts to connect and to try to deal with issues like that, nothing happens. She tries to get counseling. She reads books. She tries to become vulnerable. She, all sorts of things. And you get to a place where I don't know if it's anger or fear or what, but you cannot make love with your spouse. I mean, at least a woman can lie there and think of England, so to speak. But I have no idea how a man would fake it. So what would you do if you found yourself in a situation where... I think it's common when relationships don't work to say, you know, it takes two to tango and that kind of thing. But it seems to me, I've seen a lot of relationships where there is one... the lion's share of the dysfunction can be laid at the feet of one person. Of course, nobody's perfect, but I've seen lots of relationships where one person is clearly significantly more dysfunctional than the other person. And I cannot see that there's any hope for this relationship ever being functional because this other person is so seriously messed up. So
I don't think I quite have the question.
The question is regarding the duty thing. What should, if you're in a relationship that both people do not have the same understanding of marriage, of the end, what the object of marriage is, or if your mate disgusts you and you've tried everything you can think of to try to achieve the intimacy that would overcome that and you haven't, what should you do? Lie there and think of England? Divorce? If you're a man, is there any option? Viagra?
You're the man, Jack. Answer this question.
I mean, I felt at the time I could, at the same time as I could understand what this.
Why don't we hold that just for a minute, so that we can
address
that and maybe some other questions.
Okay.
Is that all right? There's a lot there.
It's hard to answer that. I really liked what Christine said and what was implicit in some other things that she said about. I mean, if I were to answer the question with respect to a young man, how should I be thinking about getting ready for a lifetime of marriage and sex? Men need to learn compassion, I think. I think this comes naturally to us. Maybe this is just me. Maybe I'm just weird. But one of the things that was the biggest surprise to me is that my wife's sexuality was not just a clone of mine. And that part of the task of learning to be sexual together was going to have to be to work at understanding her, knowing her, learning who she was, not only as a person, but sexually. And from a man's perspective, that means being patient with something that you don't necessarily understand. So if I'm not prepared to sacrifice that is to say, sacrifice what I want, sacrifice what's desirable for me for the sake of the relationship, then I probably could coerce her and get sex, but I'm going to lose the relationship. Or I can, for the sake of the relationship, forego sex, be patient about getting sex, in order to work on the relationship, and as Christine said, then I think the sex will come. Now, how is that answering your question? It's probably not.
It's kind of like in that relationship, what I heard, Jack, was they've done everything. I mean, if they truly have, then if you've done everything, then there's nowhere else to go if you've done everything. It's kind of, I felt like I was kind of back more and more into a corner of what do you do when there's nothing to do? It's like, what do you do in a burning building when you're against the wall? Well, eventually the fire gets at you. You're there. But I would say two things. One is I have a different perspective in that I think that often when we see an imbalance in relationship, very often one is much more covered than the other. There's a lot of really nice people out there. I can't tell you how many people in communities that I've worked in who are the liked people of the community. Everybody thinks they are stellar, whose daughter came in, held at knife point, and sexually abused by them for years. That is my common experience with nice people. Very, very nice people. Very, very respected people. Sometimes we just don't know what's out there. Now, I'm not saying that that's necessarily true about him, but I think that what looks very obvious as good may not be at all. I think of a woman that I've been working with for a long time who spent a long time complaining to me about her husband and all the problems that he had. And I think what she's finally come around to after a long time is, oh, this is about me growing up. And I think that's where we need to come to in any relationship is, oh, this is about me growing up. And that's where we go. Maybe we'll never be able to sexually perform. But, oh, this is about me growing up. Okay, other questions?
I would echo the same thing. I had grandparents. I thought you were describing my grandparents in your example. And right up to the end, I thought that my grandfather was just this incredibly patient man, and my grandmother was really a shrew, and I couldn't believe that he stayed with her all those years and was so patient and kind. But as he got older and some other things came to light and he became less inhibited and more of who he really was came out, I think I began to see my grandmother in part was my grandmother because my grandfather was my grandfather.
Yes. We always need to look at the dance in relationships. Always look at the dance. you don't dance alone. And it can be very hidden. And people get away with a heck of a lot because their dance looks better. But they're dancing. Larry?
Well, I was thinking, in adding to what you were saying about what always appears to be isn't always so.
This is my husband, Larry.
And it's just the notion that when we are in a relationship, it's where God has placed us. And we have to work with ourselves in that relationship. And I don't think we have the luxury of stepping back and claiming innocence, ever. We always have to look at ourselves, always have to look at what I'm responding to, how I've responded, whether I'm a loving person or not. And I just can't step back, no matter how bad I may think this other person is. I'm not responsible for what they do. I'm responsible for what I do and how I act and whether I'm a kind person or an honest person. And I have to work with that. I have to respond to that, whatever my circumstances is. And I can't step away and claim innocence under any condition. And
that's not a very popular thing. But I think we miss out. I think you're saying that's how we miss out, is if we claim innocence. How about some questions about sexuality specifically? We're talking about relationship. It's not often that we get to talk about sex and sexuality and try and be this open in a group. I know it's also hard to ask questions, but Catherine.
In the context of a relationship, and you're describing the act of sex as being a manifestation of how two people interact emotionally. And so being a single person, I don't anticipate waiting until I get married to be in touch with some part of myself emotionally to see that manifestation. And I guess I'm wondering, how does someone go about developing the aspects of vulnerability in the context of being single when you don't have that arena of sex to sort of be an indication? I'm not saying that sex is a meter for how vulnerable we are with each other, but you know, when you're saying we are all guarded, I know I'm very guarded, and I have a desire to become unguarded, and so I guess I don't know. I'm asking about, maybe you can give me some words of wisdom, or us who are guarded out there. You know, and single.
We tried this analogy on, and I'm not sure it's going to work, but my having children has really struck at the very core of me and where I fail. It really grows me up. But I didn't have to have children for me to be grown up by God. And I think sex is a really good way, like children, to be grown up by God. But it certainly isn't a prerequisite. It's a wonderful other expression. But it certainly can't be that sex is a part of what you have to do, or you don't get the benefits that God has in life, because he certainly doesn't have everybody in a marriage. But as a married person or a single person, I think I have the same responsibility to look at my guardedness, protectiveness when it comes out, and to work with it. And I think as a single person that's more difficult because Larry's right in front of me and I can see myself wailing on him. I don't get to leave. I think it's much more difficult as a single person. It takes maybe even more courage to, where you could walk away more easily, stay with it, work with it. I don't, Nancy is great at this. She's the one to ask about this. But am I anywhere close, Nancy, to what you might say? Ms. Scott?
I think life brings us things. I think you're right. It's easier to walk away because you don't have somebody living with you that is forcing you to see yourself.
You have to keep going toward it.
Right. Yeah. And I think that that's a good thing to learn to do for growing up with or without a marriage, both as a preparation for a marriage, if God gives that, but also for growing up, if He doesn't give it.
All of us grow up. It doesn't require marriage or sex or children. We're all in relationship with ourselves and with the world and with each other, and either we take that on or not, whatever context we're in.
Yeah.
And you learn the same things that I do. You're not married and I am, you know, in different ways.
I pursue relationships with people who value working with their regardless.
Nancy does.
Nancy does.
Yeah.
That's important.
Yeah, it can't just be...
It's not just going to happen.
Unsubstantive, yeah.
Yeah, it's a conscious choice.
Let me raise a question for all of you. Maybe I'm missing the point or not understanding it, but is the goal as a single person to be unguarded? My initial reaction would be there's not necessarily any virtue to be unguarded, that there's anything that love demands that I be unguarded, if I understand what unguarded means.
No, if I'm guarded, then I never look at the truth of myself, and that's what guardedness keeps me from.
So I'm guarding myself from myself?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
From truth.
Okay. I thought by guarded you meant protecting yourself from others. And that just seems right and natural to a certain extent. But what I must never do is be dishonest with myself.
Right.
I mean, that's what's crucial.
But one of the points Christine made was that struck me was in a marriage, or even when you're single and you have friends, it's like a dance or a marriage still in a sense, but it's learning how to give and learning how to receive. And to me, part of not being guarded is learning how to do that. And I've heard you say, Jack, that, you know, us loving God is manifested in how we love each other. And you can't do that in isolation. And so it's like if someone lives in isolation, they're not able to receive God's love from other people or even love God by loving others. So that's kind of, I guess, where the guardedness comes in, because you're really keeping yourself isolated from, you know, God working in your life through other people.
Yeah.
So I guess it is a virtue in a way to not be guarded.
Yeah, rightly understood. I agree. It's a virtue. I think marriage is a unique relationship where we're actually called upon to trust another person, and that's part of what I'm promising in marriage is that I will learn to trust you, I think. And in other relationships outside the context of marriage, where I've made no promises like that, trust will be measured and proportionate to what's to the person being trustworthy, proving themselves trustworthy. So all I was saying is that there's really no virtue in trusting untrustworthy people, you know, just for the sake of some kind of openness. But what is absolutely crucial, and I understand now that that's what you're defining as guarded, what's absolutely crucial is that I don't have a vested interest in lying to myself about myself, either to myself or other people. That I don't have a vested interest in keeping myself from the truth about myself. And that's I agree. That's absolutely fundamental to the work of faith, is to learn that kind of honesty, that kind of courage to face the truth about myself is absolutely crucial.
Well, that's it. It's like more than crucial, isn't it? It's like
it's it.
That's it.
It's the essence of it.
another question?
There's somebody way in the back, Nancy. Oh, way
we have time, I think. Are we past time?
Oh, we are. We're past time.
We're past time, and yes, we have time.
Sure, we'd love to hear your question.
Okay, you guys talked about, or rather, it was talked about getting to know your body, and in terms of, like, in helping your mate to understand how to connect with you and stuff. And my mind instantly, when I hear that, leaps to something that I don't think you're really talking about. So I'm wondering if you could flesh that idea out for me a little bit, and, like, how a healthy attitude has gone toward that and what it exactly means and stuff. Because I didn't think I really understood what that was about.
Well, your mind might be going to what I'm talking about, and Jack and I may disagree. I think we have before. I think that one of the ways that we teach our mate how to... I wrote it down so that I could say it appropriately. Let's see if I can find it. I think masturbation in some contexts is very appropriate and very helpful. And that's one way that we get to know our bodies. I think many women have a very difficult time looking at their bodies, looking at their genitals, touching themselves, touching their genitals. They're very protected. I'm not speaking for men here as much, but they're very protected about what they will allow their husband to see or to touch or to know. And that is a huge obstacle to freedom and to vulnerability in sexuality. And so if women get to know their bodies both by touching them, seeing them, looking at them, learning what stimulation works for them and what doesn't, it can be very helpful to educate your husband. And so self-stimulation in the context of being with your husband, I think, is a very valuable thing. Can be a very valuable thing, and it can be very misused.
And I'm not altogether convinced, but...
But I'm the authority here tonight, so you can listen to me.
You're tied into the responsibility. Working with yourself and your own fears, in some contexts, it can be really helpful.
Define the context a little more.
The context?
You said in context it can be good, and then you said your husband it can be good. What do you mean by... I'm trying to look at it from the opposite perspective for a man, and how it can be good and what kind of context it could possibly be good.
For the man?
For a man.
I'm much more reluctant to speak about a man's perspective, in part because although I've worked with lots of men, it just happens that my client load has been skewed in the direction of men who have been very sexually interested and whose wives have not been. And so that isn't an issue in my counseling, where I have a lot of experience with women, and that's not an experience in my marriage. So, Jack gets to answer that one.
Well, that may be the difference in perspective that we have, is partly, I'm not aware, I don't have any counseling experience, so this is no sample, but just... It's not my experience with anyone that I know that men need to be aware of their bodies in any important way. I don't think masturbation is about self-knowledge and self-discovery for males, that in my experience.
I think you might be right there, is that
it's just the male-female thing that's so different.
That may very well be.
Yeah, I think you might be onto something there. What do you think, Claire?
I think there's a big difference there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the context you're talking about would be solely for women.